Hello, listeners. My name is Rhonda Morris, and I'm the Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer at Chevron. Chevron is proud to sponsor the Lead from the Heart podcast. I am here with my colleague, Barbara Harrison, who is a Vice President in our New Energies organization. Barbara will share a short story about a leader whose simple and kind act had a long-lasting influence on her career and how she leads others.
Thank you, Rhonda. I started my career in the early 2000s at our refinery in Richmond, California. My first role was as a process engineer in plant support, working directly with operations and maintenance on daily optimization and turnaround execution. I loved both the work and the people I worked with. Within a few years, I moved into a lead engineering role, supervising a group of engineers supporting a business unit. I was early in my career, eager to impress, and part of a leadership team for the first time. There was a really impactful moment early into that job that has shaped how I lead to this day. We were preparing for a planned event at the end of the week and gathered with the business unit manager going through the plans. As we finished the meeting, he said, "Looks like we have a great plan in place. Good job. Also, just to let you know, I won't be here. My daughter has a school event and I've promised I'll be there." He then highlighted that she was nearing graduation and that there would only be so many opportunities, so that is where he both wanted and needed to be to support his family. This made a huge impact on me before I was even married, let alone had my own children. Seeing an older male leader openly talk about his priority being family, despite something important happening on site, that was a first. I thanked him after the event for sharing and highlighted how unusual it felt. He recognized this and said it was why it was so important to share the reason he wouldn't be there. Yes, he knew the team had it under control, but if that was all that he highlighted, then he wouldn't normalize completely reasonable choices or give someone else deeper in the organization the confidence to make a similar choice for themselves when it mattered to them. I really appreciated that he recognized the influence his position afforded him and ensured that he used it for the greater benefit. I think that is one of the most important and generous steps a leader can take. Steps like that is what have allowed the workplace to change and evolve, where your personal life, family, and kids, they aren't a distraction you need to hide, but a key part of what makes us, us. And now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark C. Crowley, and you're listening to the Lead from the Heart podcast. I'm certain that you'll agree that we humans are social creatures who are hardwired to connect deeply and intimately with others. And I'm also certain that you'll agree that in our busy, technology-driven lives today, that we now have fewer friends than people did in past generations, we interact less with our neighbors, and the majority of interactions we have with other people are done virtually, not face-to-face. Many of us are even working remotely some days of the week, further limiting the number of other people we see and interact with on a regular basis. For the past several weeks, I've been thinking a lot about the consequences of all of this. I'm seeing studies showing significant declines in emotional well-being in our society, not to mention startling increases in loneliness, division, anxiety, depression. And so my own conclusion from thinking this over is that we must intentionally make our workplaces spaces of connection. In other words, leaders, us, we should be pivoting in ways that ensure the people we manage feel they're part of a cohesive and collaborative team, a family even. Interestingly, research by one of my previous podcast guests, Daniel Coyle, has actually shown that members of the highest performing teams in all areas, business and sports especially, perceive themselves as being a family. And what this inherently proves is that having deep connection with the people around us elevates us, energizes us, and helps us perform optimally, and it feeds our spirits. So we need more of it intentionally, much more. Coincidentally, I happened to see Daniel Pink and Adam Grant separately recommend a book that's really all about our profound need for connection. And my guest today is its author. In her new United States bestseller, The Amen Effect, Ancient Wisdom to Mend Our Broken Hearts and World, Sharon Brous says, "We've reached the moment in time when we must restore our relationships with friends, family, coworkers, and the people in our community, all in order to honor our most basic human instinct, the yearning for real connection." Specifically, she's urging us to not only invest in relationships of shared purpose and to build communities of care, but to also, quote, "show up for one another in moments of joy and pain, vulnerability and possibility," end quote. The word amen, or amen as she says it in her book's title, is an ancient idea that we affirm the fullness of one another's experience by demonstrating in body and word that, quote, unquote, "I see you, you're not alone." I think it's really love that we're all seeking and needing, and our conversation with Sharon will be focused on seeing how leaders can support this profound human need in order to ensure their employees thrive and are able to excel in their careers. Sharon Brous has been recognized as one of the top rabbis in the United States, meaning she's the first cleric of any religion to join us on our historically secular podcast. Her book is so impressive, and so is she, and such a wonderful starting point for our discussion of how we can bring greater connection into our workplaces, that we warmly welcome her wisdom and insight. And with that, welcome to the podcast, Rabbi Sharon Brous.
Thank you. It's so good to be with you.
I've been looking forward to this conversation. It's a departure for, I think, a lot of reasons, but why don't we just dive into it? How I found you was interesting because I saw a blurb from Adam Grant. He sends out a newsletter talking about the books that he's intrigued with every quarter. And then separately, Daniel Pink. And Dan Pink says that you've crafted a profound and poetic reminder that the remedy for a fractured world is human connection. And I've been thinking a lot about human connection. So when I saw their recommendations, I thought, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. So for starters, what do you think they're both seeing about the need for greater connection for all of us?
So first of all, I'm so honored and happy to be in this conversation with you, Mark. So thank you for having me. And I'm grateful to Dan and Adam both for recommending the book and this conversation. So we're living right now at the intersection of numerous crises in our culture and our society. One of the most profound is the loneliness crisis, which our Surgeon General has been calling an epidemic. We know that this is a massive health crisis. And it's not only a crisis of spirit, but it's also a crisis of body. What we now know from this whole wealth of research and literature that's emerged in the last decade and a half is that loneliness not only breaks our hearts, but actually literally breaks our hearts. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of health outcomes that we now know. Loneliness is the equivalent on the body of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. We know that it leads to inflammation and early onset disease and all kinds of illness. So it's hurting our spirits, it's hurting our bodies, and it's threatening our democracy. I often think of the brilliant 20th century philosopher Hannah Arendt, who writes that loneliness and social alienation, isolation, are preconditions for totalitarianism, that conspiracy theories and tyranny cannot take hold in a society in which people are connected to each other, in which people really know and trust their neighbors. And we're really living in a time now in which we don't know and trust one another. And we're seeing all of the effects across the board of that very dangerous trend in our lives, in our communities, and in our society. And I suspect that that's what Adam Grant and Dan Pink and the Surgeon General and I are all addressing from our various vantage points, social psychology, medicine, and spirituality and faith, trying to figure out how can we help people reestablish connection to one another when our strongest instinct is to retreat from one another and further entrench away from one another. How can we instead find our way to one another?
So I've told this story before, but when we started to reopen workplaces after the 1 year of COVID, you know, where basically we shut everything down and deployed people to their homes to work. When we started to reopen workplaces, I wrote an article for Fast Company and I said that full-time remote work is the worst idea possible for the simple reason that it's going to undermine our connection to one another.
Yes.
And I think I had written at least 25 articles for them and had never gotten a single word of anything, but I really enjoyed this and this was great and I learned something from it. Instead, I got, you must be a corporate shill because you're telling us that we need to go back and work in the office and I've got plenty of friends outside of work and I don't need work buddies. And it was really kind of shocking to me. So there's a part of me that thinks like there's some people that don't really realize how lonely they are or how disconnected they are. But let me back up and ask you, how did we get here?
Well, first of all, the trend had begun long before COVID. I think COVID exacerbated the trend of social disconnection and alienation and loneliness. But some of the most worrying studies about loneliness were actually completed in 2018, 2019. The trends that say that 20% of Americans say that they don't have one single confidant in the world, not one person who they really trust with their hearts, someone who can help hold their fear, their worry, their grief, their longing, their love. And that's really hard to imagine. One in five Americans don't have a single friend. We know that 30% of Americans before COVID did not know the names of their next door neighbors. And so this is really a society that's trending hard in the wrong direction right now. And I think that, you know, it's clear in a lot of the long-term studies on loneliness that 2012 was a very critical year, the year that essentially the whole world got onto social media. And there are all kinds of analyses now that precisely the very technologies that were created ostensibly to help us connect with one another have in fact done exactly the opposite and created real division in our society. And you see, look, you go to a restaurant now and you'll see entire families sitting at the table together, but staring at their phones and not looking at the people who are sitting across from them. Even people on dates are doing that. And so I think that technology is certainly a part of this. And then the broader political climate, the layers of crises, including the climate crisis and the democracy crisis, fear for the future, is leading people to a posture of retreat. And that was only then exacerbated by COVID, which then habituated us to real separation from each other. And people got really used to just staying at home on their couches instead of trying to re-enter social environments where they could find their way to one another.
I always thought that instinctively that when we felt lonely, we being human beings, that the feeling of I am lonely would almost inspire or motivate us to go out and be with other people, like to remedy that I need to go and be social. And you've now used this expression retreat from each other a couple of times. So you're describing this in a way that confuses me because I'm thinking naturally we would want to be with people. And instead you're saying we're actually going the opposite direction.
Right. And here's what's interesting about the science of loneliness, which is generally when our bodies experience pain, it's a signal to the brain that we need to do something in order to keep ourselves safe. So that's the hand on the stove. Send signals to the brain saying, move your hand, otherwise you're going to be in real danger here. The pain of loneliness actually sends a signal to our brain that has us do the opposite of what we need to be doing in order to alleviate the suffering. So the pain of loneliness calls us to pull away from each other more when actually the antidote to loneliness is community and connection. And so we have to actively counter the instinct to pull away and instead root ourselves in community and in connection. It's totally counterinstinctual for us.
It's interesting. So, I mean, that is the thesis of your book.
Yes.
So I live in California. Your book made it to the bestseller list, at least in the Los Angeles Times for several weeks. So just in terms of your own audience and people that you interact with, what's the feedback that you're getting from the book? Like, how are they responding besides buying the book? How are they responding to the message?
It's interesting. I've been traveling around for the last 2 months now, just speaking with all kinds of communities in conversation around the book. And people are so desperately hungry for a message that helps us hold this impossible time that we're living in right now. And I think what I'm witnessing is that people feel powerless, that there's so much happening in our lives and in the world that we feel We have no agency to respond to. And the message of the book is we are not powerless, that we can actually respond to the crises of our time. Every single one of us has the power to respond to it. And the way that we respond is strikingly simple. It's actually by turning to one another and showing up in celebration, in sorrow, and in solidarity, by opening our hearts to one another's most human experiences, allowing ourselves to see one another and be seen by one another, that fundamentally changes us and it changes our communities and our broader society. So what I've seen is that people are really hungry for this message because there's a great sense of desperation right now. It seems that everything's spinning out of control. And suddenly with this conversation, people are saying, okay, I know what I can do. My neighbor's mother just died. I'm going to show up with lasagna tonight. I'm just going to show up. You know, I'm going to pick up the phone and call someone who I haven't spoken to. I'm going to join a book group. I'm going to join a church or synagogue or bowling group, whatever it is, because I know now that I actually have to take this into my own hands.
Well, this is the reaction you were hoping for. So it definitely sounds like you've timed this well. And as we progress into this conversation, I want to convey to our listeners that personally, I believe it's their job to create family. Really, connection is where I'm going. So in other words, I think that, and I'll be looking for your confirmation or otherwise, that we spend most of our time at work and with the people that are our colleagues, and that one great place to start to implement what you're talking about is by being proactive and creating connection intentionally. Do you agree?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And the work culture in our community was transformed about a decade ago, because once we realized that work culture actually matters, it really matters that it's not just about productivity and about getting the job done, but it's about seeing the human beings who are in the office with us and who are a part of this, you know, sacred work, the sacred mission of building community together. And so I remember reading something, Mark, you probably wrote it. I mean, it was about a decade ago. Somebody wrote that we should not allow cell phones into staff meetings, into the all staff meetings.
100%.
And the reason why I thought this was so striking was not just because it's rude when people are scrolling through their phones when somebody's trying to present or talk. It's because when everybody's walking for the 2 o'clock staff meeting at 2:05, walking down the hall, getting to the conference room, if you have your phone in your hand, you're looking at your phone, you're not looking at your coworker. And if you don't have your phone, you ask your coworker, hey, how are you feeling post-surgery? Do you feel like you've gotten your strength back? How's your mom doing? By the way, I know your brother was in town. How was the visit? So we suddenly start to kind of humanize the people who we work with. And it turns out that that makes us enjoy being at work a lot more, which also helps us build a more productive and more creative and more satisfying workplace environment.
So that's wonderful. I think I probably should have you pinned down even with more clarity than you've articulated so far. Like, what is the reason that we need connection? Like you said, it affects our hearts, it affects our well-being. Loneliness is equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. This sounds like there's science around this.
Yeah.
But I want to speak to the spiritual side of you as well. Your knowingness around what human beings need.
Well, I'll tell you, I went years ago to the West African country of Liberia, which had been for many, many years in a just horrific civil war that just devastated the country. And the war was ended by these incredibly courageous women who essentially stepped into the public square and said, we're not leaving until the militia men and the government forces lay down their arms and make peace. And I went with a group of folks to Liberia to meet with these women who so courageously had stepped into the breach. And at one point, they were telling us their story. It was a few years after the war's end. And one of the women stopped in the middle of her story and she just looked at us and she said, my God, you know, this group was from New York, Chicago, and LA. It was a group of Jewish people. And she said, my God, you came all this way just to hear our story? And she started to cry. Mm-hmm. And I realized what she fundamentally needed was just to be seen. Like a bunch of Jews from America got on a plane and flew across the world to just see and hear her story. And it was incredibly affirming for her. And the reason it struck me as so powerful was because in my work pastoring to the community, I realized that that very need was at the heart of almost every pastoral conversation that I was having with congregants who would come in, whether I was helping a couple that was going through a difficult time or helping an individual who said that they were in a spiritual crisis or helping parents who were struggling with difficult teenagers, that what we fundamentally need as human beings is to be seen by the other. We need others to see our pain and to affirm it, to see our joy and to affirm it, and we need to see one another's. And so I think that what I've discovered is that that's really at the heart of who we are as human beings, what our need is, and really what our superpower is, that we have the ability to give this to one another. And it could be one of the greatest and most significantly impactful gifts that we could give each other. Just the gift of paying attention to one another, really seeing each other as whole people in our brokenness and in our beauty. And I think that that is really at the heart of spirituality, is the need and the desire to be seen and to be known. For some people, that manifests as some kind of religious practice. They want to reveal their heart before God or the Holy One. But for other people, their spirituality doesn't even have anything to do with God or some kind of divinity, but has to do with the need to reveal themselves in their truth to another. And that feels to me to be a very profound and universal human need.
What do you say to a manager listening in? I'm hoping that there are no one listening is actually thinking this, but what would you say if a manager said, everything you're saying sounds really wonderful, but it also sounds exhausting with everything else I got to do?
I mean, I'm sure that you could show how organizations and businesses are more productive when people have positive feelings toward their coworkers and how that impacts the way that they work. But I can tell you that without the data, but just from human experience, just as somebody who's been pastoring to a community of thousands of people now for the last 20 years, I know that when people feel affirmed in their work, they will dedicate their heart and soul to that work. And when people feel disrespected or invisible or marginalized or unseen, then it manifests in all kinds of unhealthy ways in the workplace. And so to those managers who are thinking about this in a kind of cynical way, I would say, I believe that it bears out in the data that your people will actually do a better job at work if they feel cared for. And even beyond the productivity, I mean, part of our work in the world is to actually see and affirm one another's humanity. And that is something that we should be striving to do in every aspect of our lives, whether we're like in a social environment, or we're in the grocery store, or we are in the workplace, or we're in the boardroom. So I'll tell you, Mark, I'll tell you a story. So the other day, I was really racing to a meeting, driving from one meeting back to my office and late, as per normal for me. And I had to stop in the supermarket to pick something up. And so I grabbed what I needed and I went to the checkout, and I had to make the decision between going to the electronic checkout, the self-checkout, or going to the human checkout where there was a cashier and then somebody bagging. And of course, because I was late, I thought, I'm just going to run through the self-checkout and I'll be back in my car and I'll get to the meeting, no problem. But I had this moment where I just thought of my grandfather. And my grandfather, who died about 15 years ago, I thought my grandfather would be so disappointed in me if I chose the machine over the human. I'm just going to the human checkout. And so even if only just to say hello to someone and smile at them today. And so I went to the human checkout, and it did take longer because I said hello to the person. How are you? Fine. The person who was bagging my groceries then stopped and looked at me and he said, wait a minute, I know you from somewhere. And I looked at him and I said, I know you from somewhere. And it took us about, 90 seconds of Jewish geography to realize that he went to the same camp that my kids went to years before. Okay. Wow. He says to his manager, can I take off for a moment? I need to go talk to the rabbi. So he and I walked outside and he told me that his cousin was going into surgery and was probably going to die. And could I pray for her? And could I ask my community to pray for her? And I said, of course I would. And so we said goodbye. And I went to my community that weekend and I shared the name of this person's cousin. And I asked the community to pray for her. And they did. And I felt so honored to be able to have had that human encounter when I easily could have chosen the machine. So I think we make these calculations often about productivity and not about what will enhance our humanity. I felt not only did I give him a moment of grace and a moment where he felt seen, and he's at work, but he's worried sick about his cousin, you know, but I felt better because I felt like I actually could help another human being when what I was really there to do was just pay for the groceries and leave. So I feel like we need to reorient ourselves in all aspects of our lives, including at the workplace, to think about if the goal is not actually the profit and the bottom line, but if our goal is to create an environment of human wellness and thriving, then how does that change the way that we engage one another on the day-to-day, in the big moments and in all the small moments in between?
This is wonderful, Sharon. And I want to highlight something you said at the very end, which is what I anticipated. You said, I felt better.
Yes.
And so sometimes we think, well, this is going to be, you know, here comes Bill. I got to ask him about his weekend. You know, right. Now I got to hear his, right? You know, I mean, I'm taking that cynical aspect that you were describing. But sometimes we do think that. It's like, I got to go to a meeting. I got to get this thing done. I really don't have time to hear about Bill telling me about his weekend, that kind of a thing. But what I find is that every time I make the decision that you made, to have the interaction, to speak to someone, that I'm enriched in it. Like I got more than I gave. And so it's mutually fulfilling to make this investment in people.
Yes, absolutely. And just the other day, a wonderful educator in my community who I love very much told me that she's listening to my book as the audiobook. And so these ideas are running through her mind all the time. And she said she was sitting down in the pottery studio. She's a potter when she's not in the classroom. And she said that there was a stranger, someone she didn't know, sat down across from her and they started chatting. And do you have kids? Do you have kids? And he said, my son's 32, my daughter's 26, and my other daughter was 28. And then he got up and he sort of walked away to go get more clay or something. And she had this moment where she thought, you know what? Like, I don't know this guy. I think like I could easily just like put on my headphones and move on or disengage or, you know, and she decided I'm just going to engage. And so she actually walked over to him and she said, hey, I heard you say something. It sounds like you lost a child. Do you want to talk about it?
Wow.
And the guy welled up with tears and they sat down and they talked for over an hour about his beautiful daughter who had died by suicide a couple years earlier. And one of the things that he revealed was that because of the nature of her death, like most of the people who are close to him have avoided talking to him about it, totally retreated from him because they don't know how to deal with what they consider to be like an awkwardness around the loss. And as a result, he feels totally isolated and he was desperate to talk about it. And so she said to me afterwards, she said, I know I helped him. I know that I helped him because he needed to talk about her. And I gave him the opportunity to talk and share pictures and engage. And she said, but it's not just that. She said, he helped me because I felt like I had actually helped a human being today. And so I'm so grateful that I was able to step into his life and be able to, you know, be a portal through which he could engage his memories of his daughter.
Can you speak to that awkwardness and how we overcome that? So somehow this person was able to master that and have an hour-long conversation without getting into touchy ground, if you will. How do you approach somebody who has, you know, they're going through a divorce, they've got a child that's very ill, something that feels awkward to talk about? You're a master at this. How have you learned to deal with this?
Well, the first is to recognize that there are lots of very good reasons why we don't engage in conversations like that. We're afraid we're going to say the wrong thing. We're afraid we're going to trigger someone else's grief. Like in the story I just gave you, for example, someone might think, you know, I heard what he said, but if I ask him about that middle child, What if he's feeling okay today and then all of a sudden he starts to get emotional and he's re-triggered in his mourning? But what I've learned from many years of walking down this path with many brokenhearted people is that they're always holding the grief. And when we don't engage it, we're only making them hold it alone rather than saying, hey, I also recognize you right now as a person who's bereaved. So we also fear that grief is contagious. We fear that divorce is contagious. I mean, we think that if we really get close to somebody who's had a loss, especially a traumatic loss, that it forces us to confront our own vulnerability. And that's terrifying, and we don't want to. There are lots of good, legitimate reasons why we pull away from each other in pain. But the heart of my book is looking at this one ancient ritual from 2,000 years ago that's a pilgrimage ritual, which essentially calls us into relationship at exactly the moment when no party wants to be in relationship, when a brokenhearted person shows up and the people who are doing okay have to see them, see their brokenness, and ask them about it. They ask an open-hearted question, which in the language of the Jewish tradition is simply malach. What happened to you? Tell me about your broken heart. How are you holding your grief today? Do you want to talk about your child who you just mentioned? So, like, how are you holding memory as you come upon the 1-year anniversary of the loss of your beloved? Those kinds of open-hearted questions. And also the ability to offer blessing. And here, this might be really hard, especially for people who don't see themselves as religious in any way or even spiritual in any way. But in the ancient ritual that's at the heart of the book, once somebody would see a brokenhearted person, ask them a question, the person would answer saying, "My heart is broken because my father died and I'm completely bereft." And then the other person would say, "May you be held with love as you navigate this time of so much pain and heartache. May you always know that you're not alone, even as your kid goes through this terrible struggle. You know, even as you're navigating illness, you know, may you remember that you're loved." These kinds of blessings, which were not given by the high priests, they weren't given by the rabbis, they were given by the people. And the idea is that we may not use religious or even spiritual language, but we have the ability to see each other, to be curious about each other, to hold one another's pain with compassion, and even to bless each other. Like, I hope that you find the strength that you need to help you navigate this cancer treatment, we could say to somebody. And to not be afraid to step into one another's lives with that message.
So everything just flows out of you beautifully. So I'm going to ask you a very big question here. First, I want you to define the title of your book. So I want everybody to understand what you mean by amen, and maybe even give us more of a non-secular definition of that as an equivalent. But big picture here, the goal that I had for having you on, by the way, this is completely enriching, and we could stop right here, and I would say this is already a wonderful conversation. But what I really am hoping to do is take that leap and to speak to leaders and say, here's how you can create a culture where everyone who's on your team is doing this for one another. So I'm hoping that you can give us some guidance on how to do that, but start off by telling us about amen.
Sure. I chose this title because amen is a word that has resonance in so many different traditions. In the Jewish tradition, we say amen or amen. Christians say amen. Muslims say amin. There's echoes of ancient Yoruba African traditions. There's this powerful idea that we can affirm one another's moments of greatest joy and greatest pain with a simple expression of presence. That we can say essentially, I see you, or I am with you. I mean, that would be sort of the kind of secular equivalent, I think, to amen, which is, I can see that you are struggling right now. I'm not going to try to fix you. I'm just going to be present with you. I'm going to sit here with you in the darkness. I'm going to meet you in the dark night of the soul, and I'm not going to be, even if I'm afraid, I'm not going to abandon you here, which is, I think, a very powerful and resonant idea for people of faith and for people who don't identify as people of faith. The idea of sacred companionship, sacred accompaniment, that we can essentially say to someone, I am not going to leave you to navigate this period of darkness alone, But instead, I will be here. I will check in on you. I will ask you, you know, how are you feeling today? How are you navigating your grief today? I'm at the grocery store. What can I pick up for you today? Those sorts of things are really powerful, especially when somebody's struggling in the depths of a crisis. Now, how can that translate into workplace culture? First of all, by acknowledging that workplace culture actually matters, that beyond productivity, we are human beings. And when we're not well, it matters. And it has an impact on everybody who's in our midst. Several years ago, I decided that I wanted to implement a 5-minute one-on-one check-in that each person would have with every other person in the organization at the end of each staff meeting. So the vision was to create kind of a wheel, and we would turn the wheel, and every day at the end of staff meeting, every week at the end of staff, there'd be a new person with whom we would have a one-on-one meeting. Just a quick check-in, like, hey, you know, how are you holding?
Just you and that person?
Just every, and each person and another person, meaning everybody in the staff would have a brief one-on-one check-in.
Great.
It's not about work, not about like, what are you working on? But did you see a good movie over the weekend? You know, how are you holding up? I know your father died 6 months ago. How are you navigating that? I know you're just back at work after parental leave. How does it feel? Is it hard to be back, or is it a relief to be back at work? Like, those sorts of encounters in which every person would have that opportunity with every other in the organization. We ended up spending a lot of time really diving into workplace culture at ICAR, my community in Los Angeles. And the team devised all kinds of ways that we could see each other. Like, we have magic markers and giant coloring book pages that are on the table during staff meetings now. And they color a little bit and then pass it down. And so everybody's contributing to making this kind of collective art piece together, which might feel really, you know, like elementary school, but something comes out in us when we're using color and good markers together. Like, it inspires our curiosity and our creativity. And we're all building off of what the person before us did. We have these all-day staff retreats where, you know, we go to escape rooms together and we eat lunch together and go on hikes together. Like, the idea is actually seeing each other as human beings. And it's very hard. I'm not going to say that it's not, but when you're really busy and you have really serious deadlines, it's really hard to say, oh my God, there's another 6-hour staff retreat. You know, we do it several times a year. And yet every single time when we do these retreats, we end up, each of us and all of us together, feel so much better about ourselves, about the work, and about the community.
What would you say to a manager who said, well, all this happens organically, maybe not the coloring, but people are always checking in with each other. I don't need to lead this or create a moment. Do you think in the big picture that this is happening enough in our workplaces? In other words, is it happening organically or is it not?
You know, I will just say to that, it took me 10 years after we built ICAR, our community, which we started in the spring of 2004. It took me 10 years before I gave my first sermon that explicitly said, we who dream of building the beloved community out in the world, a community of love and justice, have to actually start by treating one another with love and justice internally. And that means showing up for each other when someone in our community, like when one of us has a loved one who dies. That means bringing over food when someone has surgery. That means dancing together when someone has a moment of joy. That was in a faith community. And I had to explicitly say it in order for people to know that they had permission to engage one another in that way. So I'm sure that in many workplaces, people are kind to each other and might even say hello to each other on the way to the staff meeting. And some of them might even go out for drinks afterwards or happy hour, you know, and have nice relationships with each other. But when managers and directors actually take the time to say, this really matters here, that our organization actually cares about you as individuals. We don't only care about serving the mission of the organization outside, but we care about creating a culture internally in which the people who work here understand how much they matter. That makes a huge difference. And so now we start every one of our staff meetings by doing what we call a chesed check-in. That's the Hebrew word for love. And we essentially talk about the people in the community who are dealing with really challenging health struggles, or somebody they love has died, or somebody just entered hospice, or they just had a baby, or something else is going on. And that includes every person on the staff. So people will then share, you know, my aunt is really unwell and we're very close and it's really hard for me. And just giving people the space to share that helps us then understand why they seem a little bit distracted throughout the staff meeting, or why they're asking for another day off when they just took a day off last week for whatever, because suddenly we understand there's a health crisis going on in this person's family and their heart is really in another place right now. And so I believe the long answer to your short question is, it never hurts to explicitly invite people to show up for each other. That means that when we're hurting, when we're suffering inside, to invite people to share their vulnerability because they will trust that they'll be held with care in that environment. And when we're okay, to invite people to show up for others because others actually need us and are depending on us to hold them with care.
So you've got a whole framework for how you do this, but it is in a religious setting. I mean, you're a rabbi, right? So your team is inherently in the religion business, if you will. Do you see any hurdles for people in traditional non-religious workplaces to do any of the things that you just described?
I mean, again, it's a culture shift. So if all of a sudden in your business, in your workplace, the boss opens up at the next staff meeting saying, we're all going to share the deepest pain in our heart right now, that would be really inappropriate, obviously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's about establishing cultural norms, like maybe assign my book and read it together and then talk about how can we implement some of these ideas in our workplace, or assign your book and talk about it and say, you know, what are some ways that we can all feel more human together here? Now, I will say also that I do think boundaries are really important in workplaces. And so this kind of vulnerability has to be, we have to feel safe. If we're going to be expressing vulnerability, like, you know, my loved one just entered hospice, and so I'm really in a lot of pain right now. If I'm going to share that at the all hands staff meeting, I have to know and trust that I will be cared for and not penalized for that, and that boundaries won't be broken that make me feel uncomfortable, like my vulnerability is ultimately going to be used to my disadvantage somehow. And that is incumbent on the managers to be able to really establish that level of trust, that people can share something of themselves and they will be held with care and they won't find cause to regret it later.
So time is still an issue in the workplace and people have things they've got to get done. And so a reluctance would be somebody has something that's difficult in their life and now I'm going to engage in that. And my anticipation is if I engage in my employee whose mother is going into hospice, this could take a whole hour and I don't have an hour. Mm-hmm. And again, this is, you know, I'm addressing the cynical side, but I also think that it's realistic. Like people feel like if I get engaged in this, oh man, you know, this could go sideways. Mm-hmm. But I have a sense that you don't need an hour to make a difference with somebody. And so what advice would you have? Let's just frame it up this way. Busy day, lot going on. I hear somebody struggling like this. I want to go over and have a conversation and make a difference, but I don't want it to turn into a very long conversation where I can't really help them solve this problem, but I want to make a difference. I want to make an impact. I want to make a heart connection, but I also don't want to get myself in trouble. Can you maneuver through that?
Yeah, for sure. I think I would say as someone pastoring to a community, I have to deal with that question all the time because you want to see everybody who's coming to you and you also don't have time to see every person in the world to really see them. I don't mean to see them in your office. I mean to actually see them in their humanity. And so we all have to make decisions about that. But I'll say a couple of things. One, if your colleague has a parent who's just entered hospice and they're all torn up about it and you don't engage it, that is going to cost you a lot more than the few minutes it would cost to actually check in with them every couple of days about how they're holding up. Right? Because their heart isn't there. And so they're not going to be able to show up at work knowing that they are seen and being cared for and being treated with care in that difficult moment in their lives. So I don't think that our job is to fix each other, to find a solution for each other. Your job, if your workplace colleague says, my father's entering hospice, is not to then go find the best hospice care in the city for them. Your job is not to help them feel okay about the fact that their father's dying. It's not okay that their father's dying. Your job is just to be human with them. It's just to be present. It's just to say amen or I see you, so that they know that when they come to work each day, there's somebody in that environment, you know, in the cubicle across the way or in the boardroom, there's somebody who sees them and understands that they're not just there to file papers and move through the workday, but they're actually also breaking inside. And so I think that that's really critical. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that everybody here has the pastoral or psychological training to engage the deepest questions of grief and traumatic loss and mourning and illness. Not at all. You're not to become somebody's therapist. Unless you're a car mechanic or a heart surgeon, your job is not to fix the person you're talking to. It's just to see them and just say, hey, I heard you're having a rough time. You know, how's your mom doing today? And that can be a game changer in any environment.
Mm-hmm. I had to go there with you. I apologize because it's sort of, you know, lesser attractive aspects of our humanity when we think like that. But, you know, been out in the world and know that we do think this way and we do have that hesitation. And your guidance is really, really wonderful, including one aspect, which is it can't be one and done.
Right.
Like, how's your mom? Oh, okay. We have that conversation. And then, okay, I check the box and I'm done. I lost a brother last fall in completely shocking, surprising, came out of nowhere. And I think I made the mistake. It wasn't a mistake, but I mentioned it in the podcast. And I've got a large social media following. And I, not only did I get beautiful messages from people, just like tracking down my email and saying, I'm thinking about you, you're in my thoughts, some people, you're in my prayers, whatever it was meaningful to me. But what made it more meaningful to me was the people who followed up like a month later, 2 months later, of just thinking about you, wondering how you're doing. And this was not like three people. This was like 100 people.
Incredible.
But it affected me in my heart. It affected me so deeply that somebody would care like that. So this matters, what you're talking about.
First of all, I'm so sorry to hear of this loss of your brother. And I really hope his memory always is a blessing for you. And I'm grateful to you for sharing this, because one of the things that I speak about in the book is that the core mourner's prayer for Jews is a prayer in which a mourner stands up in the room and says, my heart is broken. And the whole community responds saying, amen. And then they say another line, you know, I just miss him so much. And the community says, amen. And then they essentially say, amen, 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 amen. This repeated recitation of amen. And I realized at some point that what we're doing is we're gaining this muscle memory for how we show up for each other. It's not once. It's again and again and again. That it's not just a quick call after someone dies, after our friend has a loss, but it's showing up at the house of mourning and then showing up again and then calling 2 weeks later and then checking in a month later. And this kind of repeated acknowledgement that the broken heart doesn't just heal and we don't just move on, but we really need each other. Now, I'm not saying that every person in every workplace has to be engaged in relentless love with each other. But I think that somewhere between that kind of relentless love that you might experience with your core social group or your faith community or your book group or whatever it is, somewhere between that and our current dominant workplace culture is where we need to go, which is people checking in on each other and saying, hey, we talked last month about the surgery that you were nervous you were maybe going to have. How are you feeling? You know, like what's going on in your heart right now. So I'm so moved that strangers did that for you, Mark. And I hope that that love penetrated your heart and helped you navigate the really, what I imagine was a difficult time of grief.
In several instances, these were people, I'll call one out because no one knows, but one of the person who handled the planning for one of my podcast guests. And all of our interactions were back and forth on email. You know, would Mr. Somebody like to come on the podcast, and all the interactions that were going on. But since then, she and I have had several conversations all through email, no phone calls, but simply, how are you doing? And I've been thinking about you. And when you go back to the beginning of our conversation and we think about all of the challenges that our society is facing right now with disconnection and loneliness and almost infighting, you know, that somebody would want to take the time to do that. That's how much this matters. And so as I'm listening to you, I brought it up only because I'm thinking, man, this had such an impact on me. And I want people to know that. But I'm also trying to validate everything that you've said for the last 45 minutes. Not that it needed it.
It's so powerful. And there's a story that I share in chapter one about a time that I got this wrong when my rabbi, who is this beloved religious leader in New York, and I had moved to Los Angeles, and my rabbi's mother died. And I literally thought, everyone loves this guy. He's going to be surrounded by people. It's going to be oppressive how much love he'll receive. And so, like, no way am I flying in. And I don't even want to bother him with a phone call. And so I just wrote him a letter and I mailed it, which I still think is a really lovely thing to do. But next time I saw him, it was I didn't follow up. And then a few months later, I saw him at a gathering and he said to me, you know, I needed you and you did not show up for me. And he said, next time show up. And I was just so stunned by that. Honestly, I was hurt and defensive and I felt like, who are you? And I have small children at home and a community I'm taking care of and all these things. And then I just thought for a moment, what if I just take that in and take the feedback and let it change my heart? And I just started showing up in different ways. And I'm so moved that the person who you only know through work and only know through email understood that she could actually reach your heart by reaching out to you in exactly the way that would touch you in that moment. And not only to do it once, but to do it repeatedly, she understood that she could just show up. And I guarantee you that not only was that meaningful for you, but that it also meant something to her.
Completely agree. Irrefutable. Absolutely. Every interaction, I thought, this is meaningful to her, and I'm a happy participant in that, you know, for all the obvious reasons. So, Rabbi Charon, we're going to stop here for a quick departure from our conversation and move into a podcast tradition we call the Heartbeat Round. To help us learn about you more personally, I'd like to ask you just a few questions, but we want you to answer these instinctively in a heartbeat, if you will. And I'm wondering if you're willing to play.
I'm in. Let's do it.
All right, here we go. Trait you most admire in other people?
Humility.
Leader of any era you hold in the highest regard?
There's a woman in the Talmud called Buria, who was this great, brilliant woman in a time in which women were unseen and unheard. And she just bests the men of her time over and over, reminding them of really what's most important. So I'll go with Buria.
A subject that you believe all managers would be wise to bone up on?
Office culture. It really matters. It matters.
Something people would be surprised to learn about you?
I'm crazy organized in the kitchen.
Oh, wow. Like neurotically?
like with a label maker. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So that's a yes. Something you think everyone should do at least once in their life?
Oh, silent disco.
Go on.
Sunrise hike. Barefoot run on the beach.
Wonderful.
More? Okay.
No, that's good. The quality that derails the most leadership careers?
The quality, I would say burnout, but I actually think it's inequitable policy, office policies, inequitable pay, office cultures that don't honor individuals. I think that just makes it so that it's undesirable for people to stay in the roles that they're in.
Your idea of perfect happiness, besides labeling things?
Snuggling my babies when they were babies, and now staying up late talking to them now that they're big kids.
Great. Skill improvement you're working on right now?
Throwing a 3-pound salad bowl at the wheel in the pottery studio.
Oh, wow. Your greatest extravagance?
Pottery studio membership, even though I never have time to go. And organic berries.
Best book you've read in the last year?
So many. I'm going to go with Demon Copperhead.
Oh, mine too.
So good.
Fantastic
so good.
Book. quality you consider most essential to your success?
Relentlessness.
And your number one rule for wellness?
Shabbat, the Sabbath, just taking a little bit of time to breathe every week.
These are wonderful. Great answers. Thank you for going through this with me.
Thank you.
You know, something else that's been on my mind a lot is that if I was running a large company right now, I think that values and culture is something that's so important. And yet, I'm not so sure that we renew them, that we go back and say, is this the culture that we want? Do we even have the culture that we said we set out to create? And so I'm almost recommending that leaders, even within their own teams, just sit down and say, well, who are we? What do we believe? What are we trying to accomplish here together as a team, and what unites us? So I'm curious as to whether, I don't know if anyone's ever asked you this question, but do you have certain values that you would prescribe a manager absolutely create within their own team or company?
What an interesting question. I mean, I do believe that a culture of care matters profoundly in the work environment, and cultivating the expectation that we treat one another tenderly. You asked earlier about my book tour and what I've been learning from sort of going around and talking about these ideas with people over the last 2 months. And at the end of each talk that I'm doing, I'm a mourner right now because my father died just at the end of August. And so the prescribed time of mourning for a parent in my tradition is a year.
Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. So I've been traveling around as a mourner. And because when one is a mourner, it comes with the obligation to say this mourner's prayer. That's actually at the heart of my chapter one of my book and the title of the book, where people say amen to each other. And I closed the manuscript 14 months ago. So not knowing that I would be bringing the book into the world as a mourner. And so I decided that I had to say this mourner's prayer at the end of every book talk. But I also understood that there was no chance that any of the rooms I was in, I was the only mourner in the room. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of every book talk, I basically have been asking people, I'm going to invite you to just stand up if you're also holding a broken heart right now, if you have lost a loved one and you're in the prescribed time of grieving. And in every room I've been in, there are numerous people who stand up who are also brokenhearted. And it keeps reminding me that you have no idea what's going on for a person if you don't ask. And so, like, we thought we were having a conversation about love and loss and community and connection, and I'm the speaker and they're the audience. But actually, there are several people in this room who are nursing wounds of true broken hearts, and some of them tragic loss. And we would never have known that about each other if we didn't say. So translate that now to the workplace. And I would say at every moment in an all-staff meeting, there's someone in that room with a broken heart. And there's someone in that room who's probably experiencing immense joy and gratitude and wonder. Maybe they just fell in love. Maybe they just got pregnant after trying for many years and struggling with fertility. Maybe they're just relieved because their kid who's been struggling is finally okay, right? There's somebody in the room whose heart is full, and there's somebody in the room whose heart is broken. And even just acknowledging that and creating the space for people to share moments of joy that they've experienced and moments of struggle that they're in is a really profound way to tap into one another's humanity and our shared humanity. And it helps us treat one another with a different level of care than we would if we're all just kind of anonymous beings, part of the workforce, trying to bring in as much profit as we can by the end of the day.
Amen. I want to end it here. I don't think you could end it with more clarity and inspiration. So I want to say thank you so very, very much. I had all kinds of ideas about how this conversation would go, and you've just absolutely exceeded all my hopes and expectations. So Rabbi Sharon Brous, I want to say thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, Mark. Be well.
Thank you. Have a wonderful week. You too. Bye-bye. As we close our wonderful conversation on the importance of human connection, I'm reminded that previous podcast guests, Jim Harder from Gallup and Marcus Buckingham, both stressed how critical it is for managers to have at least one meaningful conversation with every direct report employee at least once a week. Brief meetings like these also provide a perfect opportunity to see how people are really doing before getting into discussions about work. If you found this or any episode of our podcast valuable, we'd be so very grateful if you'd share it with a friend or colleague. I mean, really grateful. Our brilliant theme music is the jazz classic, Take the A-Train, written over 80 years ago by Billy Strayhorn. Our version is performed by the BBC Big Band Orchestra. I want to thank my exceptional team, Mr. Ken Boynton, Carrie Finnessy, Randy Yant, Anna Boynton, and my sound engineer and producer, Eric Oz. And I also want to thank all the employees and managers at Chevron. Finally, I leave you with my two consistent reminders. When you lead from the heart, your people will follow, and love your people. This is Mark C. Crowley thanking you for listening and signing off for now.